Laugh, all of you, you pious priests of Marduk. It's a wonder any of you can even read the prayers.
Ramath came up to her.
Remember your promise to me, said Ramath under his breath.
In time, in the right time, said Asenath. The Father has the tablet hidden where you will never find it. And when the 3 days are concluded, when the army has entered through all gates, and when the Hebrews are on the march, I will see that you have its contents.
What is this other tablet you speak of? I asked.
What part does it play?
Of course I knew where it was, where my father had hidden it in our house.
A prayer for your soul, son, she said, that you may see God. And of course you know I'm lying to you.
She shook her head.
The mirth went out of her, even the hate.
It's an old charm.
You can choose, then. You'll be dying. It's nothing to worry you now. Just a charm, such as the ancients believed, that's all, nothing else. The rest that we do here is medicine, not magic.
They led me through the palace, and now we broke another ancient seal and entered together a large chamber. Servants moved swiftly past us to place the tables and the lamps. I saw a great cauldron brought in. I saw a brazier for fire that would lie on the floor beneath the cauldron. I felt for the first time total fear, fear of pain and hurt and burning.
If you've lied to me about the pain, tell me the truth, it will make it easier for me.
We haven't lied to you about anything, said the high priest. You will stand in the temple of Esagila for centuries, and you will receive our libations. Be our god. If you ever saw him, then be him. How did he become what he was if it wasn't for us?
They brought a couch for me, and I lay down on it and shut my eyes. Who knows, maybe I was home and dreaming. But I wasn't. They began to groom me. I lay there with my eyes closed, turned towards the wall, or towards them, and I felt their hands on me, clipping my hair and my beard, and trimming my nails to the perfect length. And when I had to, I lifted my limbs so that they could undress me and bathe me. And then it was dark. Only the fire beneath the cauldron burned. I could hear the old woman reciting the words in Sumerian. It was a formula, a mixture of gold and lead and other herbs and potions, some which I knew, and many which only an enchantress might know. But I knew enough to know it would kill anybody. I also realized it had in it, this brew, the seeds that people chew to see visions, and a great deal of the potions they drink to make them have wild dreams. And I knew those intoxicants would ease my pain and blur my thoughts. Who knows? Maybe I'll miss my own death, I thought.
Ramath came to me.
His face was very simple, and there was no meanness in him. He spoke almost sorrowfully.
We won't put on the final garments until dawn, he said. They are ready in the other chamber. The gold boils, but it will cool. You needn't fear. It will be cool and thick when we apply it to your skin.
Now, what can we bring you, Lord God Marduk? What can we bring you to make you happy tonight?
I think I want to go to sleep, I said. I fear that boiling gold.
No, it will be cooled, said Asenath. Remember, you must live long days whilst this gold eats into you. It will be cooled. You must be a smiling god as long as you can, and then a god with his hand lifted as long as you can, and then a seeing god as long as you can.
Yes, all right, leave me.
You don't want to pray to our own god? Asked Asenath.
I wouldn't dare, I whispered. I turned my back and closed my eyes. And strangely enough, I did sleep. They covered me with the softest blanket. That was sweet. I slept from sheer exhaustion, as though the ordeal lay behind me rather than ahead. I slept, and what I dreamed, I don't know. What does it matter? I do remember being puzzled that I didn't want to see Marduk again. I remember thinking, why is that? Why am I not weeping on his shoulder? But that was just it. I didn't want to weep on anyone's shoulder. I had been dealt the mortal blow. I didn't know what lay ahead, the smoke, the fog, the flame, or power such as his. I couldn't know, and neither could he. I think I began to sing the psalm I loved so much of home, and then I thought, the hell with it. Jerusalem will be theirs, not mine. A vision came to me. I think it was from Ezekiel, whom we were always copying at home, always fighting about, and arguing about. It was a vision of a valley of bones, the bones of all the dead, the bones of all mortal men and women and children. And I didn't think of the bones rising. I didn't think of them called to life. I simply saw them, and I thought, for that valley I do this. For that valley, for all of us who are merely human. Was I too proud? I don't know. I was young. I wanted nothing. I slept. And too soon indeed, came the lamps and the light, and the distant shine of the sun on marble floors, far from the doors of the chamber. Chapter 6. I was dizzy. I think it was the fumes. All night the kettle had cooked its immense blend of gold and glaze, such a huge amount of gold and lead and whatever else went into it. The perfume was rich and delicious, and I reeled. They stood me on my feet. I shook myself all over to waken more, to make the lamp stop hurting my eyes. That was sunlight, wasn't it? Asenath was there, and then the priests began to apply the gold. They began at my feet, telling me to stand straight and firm, and they covered my legs all over with the gold, painstakingly, in motions that were almost soothing. It was warm, but it didn't hurt. It held no sting whatsoever. They painted my face slowly. They brought the paint up into my nostrils, and they covered my eyelashes one by one. And then they took the ringlets of my hair and my beard, and one by one made them golden. By now I was fully awake. "Keep your eyes wide," said Asenath. Then they brought all the fine robes of Marduk. Now these were real clothes which were put on the statue every day. But I saw now what they meant to do, not trim them with gold, but to coat them, so that indeed I would seem a living statue. They dressed me, and this they began to do, painting each fold of the long robe, the long full sleeves, and asking me again and again to raise my arms and to walk as they did their work. I stood before a mirror. I saw myself, and I looked like the god. I saw the god. "You are the god," said a young priest to me. "You are our god, and we will serve you forever. Smile on me, Lord God Marduk, please." "Do it," said Asenath. "You see, the enamel must not harden too fast. We can't have it become brittle. And each time it does become too hard, the priests will add more to that place so that you can move the muscle. Smile. Open your eyes and close them. That's right, my beautiful boy. That's right. Do you hear that noise?" "It sounds like the entire city roaring," I said. I heard the trumpets, too, but I didn't speak of that. "I am dizzy," I said. "We will hold you," said the young priest. "Cyrus himself will hold you. Your attendants will hold you. Remember, take his hand. Hold his hand. Turn to him often and kiss him. The little gold from your lips will not harm his skin. You must do it." Within seconds we were high on the wagon, and all around me I saw the layers of flowers, every fine flower that can be grown inside or out in Babylonia, and flowers brought in from places far away, the blooms of Egypt and southern islands. We were in a war chariot atop this wagon, but the chariot's wheels were fixed, and the attendants stood lower and behind us, and holding me firmly by the waist. And one on the side held me also by the waist. And Cyrus mounted the chariot. Screams and cries came from everywhere. The gates had been open all the time. The people flooded in. The procession had begun. I blinked. I tried to see. I saw the petals flying through the air, pink and red and white, and I smelled the incense rising. I looked down, feeling a stiffness in my neck, and I saw all the priesthood and all the women of the temple prostrating themselves on the great tiled floor of the courtyard. The white mules began their slow march forward. In a daze I turned and looked at the king. How splendid and beautiful he looked! Just as we passed through the gates, there came the loudest shrieks and cries. The Hebrews were on the rooftops. I looked. It was a haze. But I could hear them singing the Psalms of Zion. The faces were small and distant. The wagon picked up speed, as much speed as a giant wagon can get, which is not much. But we were rolling steadily, you might say. And I held to the edge of the chariot with one hand, letting my golden fingers curve around it. And then I reached out as if by instinct, for no one told me. And I put my hand into Cyrus's hand and gave him the first kiss. The crowd was in ecstasy. Every house along the processional way seemed a living thing in itself, with life screaming from its windows and its roof, and life pressed up against its door. And in every side street people sang and waved palms, and again I heard the Hebrew music. The Hebrew music followed us. I don't remember when we crossed the great canal, though I think I did see the dazzle of the water. The attendants were holding me firmly and telling me harshly to be strong. "You are my god, Marduk," said Cyrus. "Bear with them, they are fools. Hold my hand, my god, for now we are king and god, and no one can deny it." I smiled, and again I bent forward to kiss his cheek, and again the screams of joy surged through the crowd. We were approaching the river. We would now be placed in the boat, and taken to the house of the ordeal with Tiamat, the god's great battle with chaos. And what would that be? I was as one so drunk it simply didn't matter. I could feel the gold hardening all over me, and I could feel it caressing me as they said it would. I had anchored my feet fairly well at last, and the attendants had their grip, and Cyrus's living hand held warm and tight to mine. And he waved and bowed and shouted a thousand greetings to the eager citizens of Babylon. A funny thought came to me as the boat moved up the river. There were crowds on all sides, and I thought, "He thinks this is all for him, Cyrus. And it's really just Babylon. Babylon having a big party or festival like it does so often. But he's never seen the city going crazy with dance and drink, and so he is very impressed. Well, let him enjoy it." Only dimly did I realize I had not seen my family. They had been there, I was sure, but I had not seen them. The house of the ordeal was splendidly plastered in silver and emerald and rubies. The pillars were gold and made to look like great lotus blossoms at the top. The middle of the roof was wide open, and all around us were crowded hundreds upon hundreds of noble Babylonians, the rich, great officials from other cities, priests who had come with their gods to Babylon for safety, and also hundreds upon hundreds of Cyrus's court, so like us, yet so different, taller, leaner, more trim, and more sharp of eye. Suddenly I stood alone in the midst of the open court. Everyone had backed away. Ramath stood beside me, and on the other side the young, compassionate priest. "Lift your arms," said the priest. "Take your sword from the scabbard." "Sword? I didn't know I had one." "You do," said the young priest eagerly. "Ah, yes, raise it high." I scarcely knew whether I obeyed. The world was swimming before me. The nobles were chanting and harps were playing. And then I heard a sound I knew from many spectacles of the past, and from the hunts with my father and brother. I heard the roar of lions, caged lions. "Don't fear," said Ramath. "These animals are satiated and filled with potions that make them sluggish, and they will come one by one as they are released, and they will rise as they have been trained to lick the honey from your lips, which I will put there now, honey and blood, and when they do you will drive your sword into them." I laughed. "And you? Where are you going to be?" I asked. "Right here, beside you," said the young priest. "This is nothing, Lord God Marduk. These lions want to die for you." He lifted a chalice to my lips. "Drink the honey and the blood," he said. I did, barely able to feel myself swallowing. I realized suddenly that almost all sensation had left my skin. I was as one in bitter cold night desert wind. But I swallowed, and he gave me more until my tongue and lips were coated with blood and honey. A terrible excitement ran through the crowd. I could see the fear. The first lion had been released and came towards me. The Persians were backing up against the walls, I think. I could feel the fear, smell it. And I laughed again. "This is so funny," I said. "I'm half dead, and this lion is staggering towards me." Suddenly the lion sprang, and the two priests had to hold me so that the lion's weight didn't throw me backwards. I lifted the sword. I called on the gold enamel to give me strength, and I drove the sword into the lion's heart. His hot, foul breath blew into my nostrils, and his tongue touched my lips. And then he fell over, awkward, dead, and the crowd sang and sang and sang of courage. Now the king came to my side, and he too had his sword, and I saw that as the second lion and third lion were released, that we were to kill them together. The king's face was as rigid as mine, and he narrowed his eyes at the beast. "They have plenty of life in them, it seems to me," he said. "Ah, but you're a king, and I'm a god, so let's kill them." Behind them the priest cracked the whip, which made one lion jump for Cyrus first, and he staggered back as he drove the sword and then kicked the animal away from him. The lion rolled on its back, roaring, dying. The second beast was in my face. I felt the priest lift my wrist. "Thrust now." I did. I thrust more than once, wanting the thing dead and off me. And once again all sang and cheered, and I could hear the crowds outside singing and cheering. I saw the lions lifted and carried out. I heard the song of the priest of the slaying by Marduk of the evil Tiamat. And from her hide he made the heavens and the earth and the seas. The words rang out in the old Sumerian. And then in Akkadian, and then in Hebrew, and it was like overlapping waves of sound, and I swam in them. I stood alone in the court. The priests were painting me with the blood and honey. "They cannot hurt you," said Ramath. "What?" I asked. But I knew. I could hear them as distinctly as the beasts. It was the bees. And now, as a great silken dragon proceeded towards me, tightly sewn with spindly gold ribs and controlled by those who worked it on sticks, I saw it was full of bees. The dragon was wrapped around me, and I was enclosed in a silken tent. Its tail even covered my head. I heard the sound of ripping fabric. The bees were loosed on me and covered my body over. I was filled with loathing, but my feet were frozen in place, and the stings of the bees did not penetrate the gold, and when they came near my eyes, I only closed my eyes, and gradually I realized the bees were dying. They were dying from their own sting, and from the poison, perhaps, in the gold. I heaved a great sigh. "Keep your eyes open," cried Ramath. And when all the bees had fallen, and the great silken dragon, now collapsed, had been offered to me to rip with my sword, there came the cries again. I was being carried up the stairs to the roof. I could see out over the open fields. I could see the crowds going on and on forever. I lifted my arm with my sword, I lifted it again and again, turning to the east, and the west, and the north, and the south, and lifting it and smiling, and the crowd sang back to me. All the earth sang back to me. "It is so very beautiful," I said, "so indescribably beautiful." But there was no one to hear me. The fresh air waked me a little, touching my nostrils and my throat, and cooling my eyes. The priestesses of the temple surrounded me, throwing flowers in the air, and then I knew I was being led away to the royal couch. "You can have as many as you want, but I advise you to sleep," said Ramath. "Yes, good idea. And how do you keep me from dying?" "I can hear your heart. You will live long enough to make the journey home. You are stronger than anyone imagined." "Then give me a harlot," I said. Everyone was upset. "Well," I said. The harlot screamed with delight. I beckoned for them to come. But I couldn't do it with them. I could only take each one in my arms and plant a poison kiss on her grateful, upturned, sweet little mouth, and send her away in swoons, to wipe off the kiss, I hoped, as soon as she could. I laughed deep in my chest with my lips closed. Other things were done that night, but I slept. Fire, poetry, dances, things I never saw. I slept. I stood, resting back at a tight angle so that I seemed to be supporting myself, and with my eyes open, painted open now with fresh gold, so that I could not close them. But I slept. The world seemed a pit of madness. Now and then I woke to see the flames and the dancing figures. Now and then I heard some whisper or sound, or heard running feet, and felt human hands clasp me. Once, I think I saw the king dancing below. I saw the king dancing with the women in a great strange slow dance, figures turning ceremoniously, and then the king threw up his arms and bowed down to me. But nothing was required of me. The smile was fixed on my face now by the hardened gold, and only when I laughed did I feel the flesh tingle. At noon the following day, as we began the procession back into the court of Esagila, I knew for sure I was dying. I could scarcely move at all. The attendants, under the cover of silk scarves and robes, fiercely painted the gold fluid on my knees to keep them flexible. But they didn't want the people to see. And I was not tired so much as stunned, staring at those before me. We came now to the gates. We went into the courtyard, where the great poem In the Beginning would be read, and the actors would begin their pageant. I felt a sadness suddenly, a terrible sadness and confusion. Something was wrong. But all of a sudden, as if it were the answer to a prayer, the thing was made right. I heard my father singing. I heard him and my brothers. "I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir." I struggled to hear it more clearly, their blessed familiar voices. "Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him." "Turn your head to them, Lord God Marduk," said Cyrus. "It is your father singing with all his heart." I turned. I saw nothing but a blur of waving arms, of garlands tossed in the air, of flowers falling, but I heard my father. "I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight, and I will give thee the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel." The singing went on and on, following us to the gates of the temple. And then came the shouts, "Messiah! Messiah! Messiah!" And Cyrus waved and threw them his kisses, and at last it was time for the coronation. We were taken down from the chariot and the wagon, and walked on a bed of flowers up and up the seemingly endless stairway of the great ziggurat Atemenanki, so that the people from far off could see us through the wide gates. I thought I might die before I reached the top. I couldn't look above, only at the golden stairs before me, and I thought of the stairway to heaven which Jacob had seen in his dream with the angels coming and going. At last we stood on the summit, the mountain made by and for the god, and I was given the crown. By now it seemed I did not control my limbs at all. I felt nothing. I smiled because it was easiest to smile, and my arms ached suddenly with tiredness as I lifted the big Persian crown of gold and placed it on the head of the living king. "Now may I die," I whispered. Exhaustion overcame me. My knees were in pain, my feet, all of me that could no longer move or stand with any freedom. Distinctly I saw the loving eyes of Cyrus. I saw the solemnity in his face. I saw the dedication to kingship in him. I saw perhaps a little of a king's madness. Slyly and cleverly, the priests crowded around me and painted me over and over, that I might move my limbs, and some vitality came back to me. "Keep your eyes open," Ramath said. "Keep your eyes open." I did. We were taken down to the courtyard. The banquet lasted for hours. I know the poets came, and they sang, and I know that the king dined and all the nobles dined. But I sat rigid, staring. My eyes wouldn't close now, whatever I did. They had been stupid to add paint. They only softened the lids when they did, I thought to myself. And I looked down at my hands lying on the table, and I thought, "Marduk, I have never once called on you." His voice came in my ear. "You have no need of me, Azrael, but I'm with you." Finally it came to an end. Darkness had fallen. It was finished. The king was crowned. Babylonia was Persia. The city was drunk beyond the palace gates and the temple gates. And within these two buildings others drank and sang. "Now," said the young priest, "we will carry you up to the shrine. You need walk no more. You need only take your place at your banquet table there. And if you do not die within a few hours, we will give you the gold in your mouth." "Not quite yet," said Ramath. "Follow me, and quickly, for we have one more ritual to perform, and it must be done properly." The young priest was confused. So was I, but I didn't care. I didn't give a damn. I didn't care at all. I was slumbering already, and when I saw the vague shapes of the dead hovering about, staring at me in fear, I was pleased. I would have thought they would have come thundering down upon me like an army and dragged me out of my gold clothes and said, "Come stumble through eternity with us." But they didn't. Suddenly I felt an unbearable heat. I saw a huge fire. I thought I heard my father's voice, but I wasn't sure. And then I heard Asenath say, "It is powerful, powerful magic. Do you want him to die? Give it to me." For one brief second I saw my father, and in confusion he gave over to her the old tablet in its clay envelope. "Azrael!" he called out. He reached beyond her, towards me. I wanted to speak, but I was past it. I couldn't do anything. The doors were slammed shut on my father and on the world. We were in a chamber with a hot, hot fire, the cauldron full of gold boiling, and the air almost impossibly hot. And Asenath then broke the clay envelope of the old tablet. She just smashed the outer clay as if it was nothing, and then she held up the secret tablet to the light of the torch. I was standing on my own, too rigid to move, too rigid to fall, staring at them. I wasn't even too horribly afraid of the fire. What were they doing, Ramath and the old woman? Where was the high priest?
Hadn't I glimpsed him now and then? And then Asenath began to read. But this was not Sumerian. It was Hebrew. Old, old Canaanite Hebrew.
And that he should see his own death, and that he should see his soul, his tselem and his spirit and his flesh all boiled together in the bones, to live in the bones forever, only to be called forth by the Master who knows his name and calls his name.
No! I screamed. That is not a charm. That is Hebrew. That's a curse. You lying witch!
The gold covering on me cracked all over as I sprang with all my drunken strength at her. But she backed up like a dancer, and Ramath had me by the throat. I was as stupefied and weak as those lions who had come against it.
"You witch, that's a curse," I said.
"That he shall see all of him that is visible and invisible, and all fluids of his body boiled down into the bones, and that he shall be bound to those bones and whoever is master of those bones, and that he shall not be taken into the darkness of Sheol, nor the eternal life of God for ever and ever."
"Marduk!" I screamed.
I felt myself heaved backwards, and thrown into the boiling gold. I screamed and screamed. It was unthinkable. It was not possible that I could know such pain. It was not possible that such a thing could happen to me, that boiling gold should choke my mouth and cover my eyes. And when I thought I would go blank mad with horror and pain, with nothing of human thought left, I shot upwards out of the cauldron, free-floating above the body that was slumped and boiling in the pot, with only one open eye above the bubbling gold. The body that had been mine, and I was not in it. I was there above, arms outstretched, staring down, and I saw the face of Asenath upturned.
"Yes, Azrael," she screamed, "watch, watch the gold boil. Watch the flesh fall from your bones. Watch the bones become the gold. Don't take your eyes off it, lest you be drawn back down into agony and death."
"Marduk," I cried.
"It's your choice," he said. "Go back down into that cauldron of pain and you die." His voice was broken or sad. I realized that he was below me. He stood looking up. And for the first time he looked small to me and simple, not grand or godly. And Asenath was just an old fool of a woman. And Ramath, staring at the body sinking into the bubbling pot, was jumping up and down and making his hands into fists and cursing and screaming. There was no time. There was no decision. Or maybe it was pure cowardice. I could not go down into that pain. I could not be boiled alive. I could not bear that such a thing would happen to any human being. I watched and I watched, and the flesh floated loose in the golden muck, and the skull floated to the top, and the pot boiled and boiled and boiled, and the room grew denser and denser with steam. Asenath was choking. She could not breathe, and she fell forward on her face. Ramath stood staring at the pot, and Marduk merely looked up at me with wonder. At last, the pot was empty, save what was left of me. Ramath kicked and poked at the fire to put it out. He drew as close as he could to the hot metal, and he looked down at the heap of golden bones that lay in the bottom of the pot. The cloth was gone. It had dissolved. The flesh was gone. It had dissolved. The liquid was gone. It had dissolved. Only the bones were left. And in this sealed chamber all the fumes and particles of what had been my body. And the bones were all gold. "Call it to you, Spirit," said Ramath. "Call the flesh to you. Call it to you now from all the world. Call it from the depth of the bones and from the air to which it has tried to flee. Call it." I moved downwards and stood on my feet. In the thick, torturous steam, I saw I had a body. It was vapor, but it was mine, and then it grew denser and denser. Marduk took a step backwards, shaking his head.
"What is it? Why do you do that?" I asked.
"O gods of old, Ramath," said Marduk, "what have you and the witch wrought?"
Ramath roared, "You are mine, servant of the bones, for I am the master of the bones. You will obey me. You will obey."
Marduk backed up against the wall, staring at me in perfect fear. Ramath grabbed a heavy bunch of cloth from the couch to protect his hands, and with this he managed to throw over the cauldron. The bones spilled out, and what did not spill he reached for, hurt by the heat until he had all the bones on the floor.
"Wake up, old woman," he screamed. "Wake up! What do I do now?"
I stood beside him. My body was dense as if it were living. It was pinkish and vivid as his body, but it wasn't real. It didn't feel real. It had no heart, no lungs, no soul, no blood. It had only the shape that my spirit gave to it, down to the last detail.
"Look, fool," I said, "Asenath is dead. If you want to know what to do, you'd better bring that tablet to me. I am the only one here who can read the old Canaanite words."
Chapter 7. Ramath did not move. He was far too frightened to move. He even let go of the bones. They lay gleaming on the glazed floor, scattered, hideous, teeth among them, and the tiny bones of my hands and feet like pebbles. Marduk remained still. There was a low, howling sound gathering round us. I could hear it as if a wind moved through the rest of the palace and temple, slowly, corridor by corridor, alcove by alcove. And then I looked up and saw the dense world of spirits as I had never seen it before. The walls and the ceiling of this cell were gone. The whole of the world was the lost mumbling souls, staring and pointing and leaping towards me with grasping hands, yet afraid.
"Get away!" I roared.
And at once the entire cloud dispersed, but the howling pierced my ears and hurt me. And when I looked again, I saw that Marduk's face was alien to me, and no longer afraid, but neither trusting nor gentle as always before. I turned, walking easily and light as a man would walk to the body of the fallen Asenath, and I took from her the tablet. The text wasn't easy for me. It was a form of Hebrew, yes, but a dialect from the time before my time. I stood reading to myself. I turned around. The priest had withdrawn to the farthest corner, and the god merely stared. I read the words as best I could. "And having seen his death, and having seen the fluids of his body, and the flesh and the spirit and soul boiled into the bones, and sealed in the bones in gold forever, let him be called down into the bones, made to enter them, and made to remain in them, until his master should call him forth."
"Do it!" Ramath cried. "Go into the bones!"
I looked down at the tablet. "And once these bones are assembled, they shall forever contain his spirit, passing from one generation to another, to serve the master by ownership and by power, to do the master's bidding, and roam only at the master's will. When the master shall say, 'Come,' the servant of the bones will appear. When the master says, 'Take on flesh,' the servant of the bones will take on flesh. And when the master says, 'Return to the bones,' the servant of the bones will obey him. And when the master says, 'Kill this man for me,' the servant of the bones shall kill that man. And when the master says, 'Lie quiet and watch, my slave,' the servant of the bones shall do it. For the servant and the bones are now one, and no spirit under heaven can rival the strength of the servant of the bones."
"Well," I said, "that is quite a story." "Into the bones," he declared. "Go into the bones." He stood trembling, clenching his fists and bending his knees.
"Return to the bones," he declared. "Lie quiet and watch, my slave," he declared. I did nothing. I studied him for a long moment. Nothing changed in me. I saw the linen he'd pulled from the couch. There was a sheet, fresh, changed from when I'd last slept here, and I picked it up now, and formed a sack out of it, and into it I put the tablet, and then the bones. I picked up the thigh bone, and the leg bone, and the arm bones, and the skull, my very own skull, still hot and gleaming with gold. And I gathered every tiny fragment of what had been Asriel, the living man, the fool, the idiot. I gathered the teeth. I gathered the bones of the toes. And when I had all of this in a small sack, knotted, I slung it over my shoulder, and then I looked at him. "Damn you into hell, go into the bones!" he roared. I went forward towards him and put out my right hand and broke his neck. He was dead before he hit his knees. I saw a spirit rise, blundering and in terror, gauzy and soon shapeless, and then dispersed and gone. I looked at Marduk.
"Asriel, what will you do?" he asked. He seemed utterly confounded. "What can I do, Lord? What can I do but find the strongest magician in Babylon, the one strong enough to help me learn my destiny and my limitations? Or shall I simply wander as I am? I am nothing, as you see, nothing, only the semblance of the living. Shall I wander? Look, I am solid and visible, but I am nothing, and all that is left of me is in this sack." I didn't wait for his answer. I turned and I left. I turned my back on him, as it were. I dismissed him, sadly, I think, and rudely and thoughtlessly, and I had a sense of him hovering near me, watching me, as I went on. I went through the temple, in the convincing shape of a man, challenged again and again by guards whom I threw off with my right hand. A spear passed through my back. A sword passed through my body. I felt nothing, but merely looked at the perplexed and miserable assailant. I walked on. I walked into the palace, and I walked towards the chambers of the king. His guards fell on me, and I stepped through them, feeling this no more than a shudder, and saw them stumble behind me. And then I looked up and saw Marduk watching from afar. I went into the king's chamber. Cyrus was in bed with a beautiful harlot, and when he saw me, he leapt up naked from the bed. "Do you know me?" I said. "What do you see?" "Asriel," he declared. And then, with genuine joy, he said, "Asriel, you've cheated death. They've saved you. Oh, my son, my son!" This was so heartfelt and honest that I was stunned. He came towards me, but as he put his arms around me, he realized I was nothing, only the appearance of something solid, as a shell, more or less, or even lighter than that, a bubble on the surface of the water so light it could explode. But it did not. I did not. I merely felt his heavy, strong arms around me, and then he backed away from me. "Yes, I am dead, Lord King," I said, "and all that is left of me is here in this sack, and covered with gold. Now you must repay me." "How, Asriel?" he asked.
"Who is the greatest sorcerer in all the world? Surely Cyrus knows. Is the strongest and wisest of wise men in Persia? In Ionia? Or is he in Lydia? Tell me where he is. I am a horror. I am a horror. Even Marduk fears me now. Who is the wisest man, Cyrus, to whom you would trust your own damned soul if you stood here as I do?"
He sank down on the side of the bed. The harlot, meantime, had covered herself with the sheets and merely stared. Marduk came silently into the room,
and though his face was no longer cold with suspicion, it lacked the warmth we'd always shared.
"I know who it is," said Cyrus. "Of all the wizards ever paraded before me, only this man had true power and simplicity of soul. Send me to him. I look human, do I not? I look alive? Send me to him."
"I will," he said. "He is in Miletus, where he roams the markets daily, purchasing manuscripts from all the world. He is in the great Greek port city, gathering to himself knowledge. He says the purpose of all life is to know and to love."
"You are saying, then, that he is a good man?"
"Don't you want a good man?"
"I hadn't even thought of it," I said.
"What about your own people?"
The question confused me. In one instant I knew a whole list of names, and I could smell skin and hair. And then the identity of these beings was gone.
"My own people? Do I have people?" I tried desperately to backtrack, to recover my memory. How had I come to this room? I could remember the cauldron. I could remember that woman, but what was her name? And the priest I'd slain. The god. The good, gentle god who stood there, invisible to the king. Who was he?
"You are Cyrus, king of Persia and Babylonia, king of all the world," I said. I was horrified that I did not know the names of those I loved, for surely I had only moments ago. And that old woman who had died, I had known her all my life. I turned and looked around the room in confusion. It was filled with offerings, gifts from noble families of all Babylonia. I saw a casket made of cedar and gold. It wasn't big. I went to it and opened it. The king watched, speechless. Inside were plate and goblets.
"Take them if you wish," said Cyrus, very well masking his fear.
"Let me call my 7 wise men to me."
"I want the casket only," I said. I emptied out the contents gently, so as not to dent these precious things, and then I held the cedar box, and I could smell the cedar beneath the red silk padding that lined it. I tore open the poor linen sack, and into this casket I put the tablet, first with all its writing, including words I hadn't even read aloud yet, and then I laid down gently my bones. I wasn't even finished when the beautiful harlot had come, and she put out a golden silk veil.
"Here, to wrap them," she said, "to cushion them."
I took it, and it wrapped the bones, and she brought me another of deep purple, and I accepted that and wrapped them more securely, so that when the casket moved now they wouldn't make any sound. I had scarcely looked at them.
"Send me into them, Cyrus," I said. "Send me into the bones."
Cyrus shook his head. Marduk spoke up. "Azrael, go yourself into them, and then come out again. Do it now, or you will never be able to do it, or you will never know. This is the advice of a spirit, Azrael. Cast aside all the particles that make up your form, and seek the darkness, and if you cannot come out, I will call you forth." The king, who could neither hear nor see Marduk, was confused. Once again he mentioned his 7 wise men, and indeed I could hear men outside the chamber. I could hear their whispering. "Don't let them enter, Lord," I said. "Wise men are liars. Priests are liars. Gods are liars."
"I understand you, Azrael," said Cyrus. "You are an angel of might or demon of might. I don't know which, but no ordinary wise man can guide you."
I looked to Marduk. "Go into the bones," he said. "I promise to use all my power to bring you out. See if you can seek refuge there as I do in my statue. You must have refuge." I bowed my head. "Into the bones, until I will myself to return. All of you that are parts of me, you are to remain near and wait for me till I summon you."
A huge wind caught the bed hangings. The harlot ran to the king, and he quietly enfolded her in his arms. And I felt immense and airy. Indeed, I touched the walls and the ceiling and the four corners of the painted room, and then the whirlwind tightened around me, and I felt the intolerable press of the howling, screaming souls. "No, you don't, damn you!" I shouted. "The bones! I have the refuge of my own bones! I go into my bones!"
There was darkness. Perfect darkness and stillness. I drifted. It was the sweetest rest I had ever known. Only I should do something now, should I not? But I couldn't. I couldn't. And then came the voice of Marduk. "Servant of the bones, rise and take form." Of course, that was what I had to do. And I did it. It was like a deep intake of breath, and then a soundless shout. I found myself again a tolerable, perfect replica of Azrael, standing beside the open casket and the golden bones. My body shimmered in my own eyes, and then grew steady. I felt the cool air as if I had never known it before. I looked at Cyrus. I looked at Marduk. I knew now that if I entered into the bones, I didn't have the power to return. But what did it matter? There was velvet sleep. There was the sleep you sleep when you are a boy and lie on the warm grass of a hill, and the breeze strokes you, and you have no cares in all the world. "Lord King," I said, "I beg you. I will go now back into the bones. Send them in this casket with the tablet to your wise man in Miletus. Do that for me. And if you do betray me, what of it? I won't know. Someone else has betrayed me, but I can't remember who it is." He came forward to kiss me. The kiss was on the lips in the Persian style of kings and equals. I turned and looked at Marduk. "Marduk, come with me. I can't remember what is between us, except that it was always good." "I haven't the power, Azrael," he said calmly. "It's as the Lord King Cyrus says. You are what the Magi call an angel of might, or a demon of might. I have no such power. The tender flame of my thoughts is fed by the people of Babylon, who believe in me and pray to me. Even in captivity, the devotion of my captors sustained me. I can't go with you. I don't even know how." His brow became furrowed. "But why trust any man, even a king?" he asked. "Take the casket yourself and go where you would." "No. Look, even now the body quavers. I am newborn and not that strong. I can't. I have to trust in Cyrus, king of the Persians. And if he would get rid of me, if he would be as vile to me and as cruel to me as all those whom I loved, if he would do that, I will find a way for vengeance, won't I, great king?" "I won't give you cause," said Cyrus. "Turn your hatred from me. It wounds me, I can feel it." "So can I said. "And it feels divine to hate, to be angry, to destroy." I took a step towards him. He didn't move an inch. He stared at me, and I felt myself gently transfixed, unable to do anything really but look into his eyes. I didn't try very hard to oppose him, but I felt his domination, rooted in fearlessness and victory, and I stood still. "Trust in me, Azrael, for today you made me king of the world, and I will see that you are taken to the Magus, who will teach you all a spirit can be taught." "King of the world? Did I do that for you, beautiful man?" I asked. I shook myself all over. Of course I knew him. I knew the drama, the lion's breath. But then I didn't. I knew nothing. Marduk spoke up. But by now Marduk was merely a spirit standing there, friendly and good. Azrael, do you know who I am? A friend? A spirit friend? What more? I was anguished. I don't remember, I said. I told him that I could remember the cauldron, murdering that nameless priest and the dead old woman. I knew the king. I knew him. But I couldn't really remember. I caught the sudden scent of roses. I looked down and saw the floor was littered with petals. "Give them to him," said Cyrus, pointing to the petals as he spoke to the harlot. And the sweet, gentle harlot gathered up the petals in handfuls. "Put them in the casket for me," I said. "What is this city? Where are we?" "Babylon," said Cyrus. "And you are sending me to Miletus, to a great wizard. I must know and remember his name." "He'll call you," said Cyrus. I took one last look at them. I walked to the windows, which were open to the river, and I looked out and I thought, "What a beautiful city this is. It is so filled with burning lights tonight, and so much laughter and merriment." Without raising my voice, I dissolved my form once more, raging at the souls as they surrounded me, and plunged again into the velvet blackness. Only this time I could smell the roses. And with the roses there came a memory of a procession, and people cheering and crying and waving, and a handsome man singing with a beautiful voice, and petals tossed so high they showered down on us, on our shoulders. But the memory faded. I was not to remember these moments, these things, what I have told here for 2,000 years. Azrael sat back. It was almost daylight. He closed his eyes. "You have to rest now, Jonathan," he said, "or you'll be sick again, and I must sleep, and I fear what will happen. But I'm tired. Tired." "Where are the bones, Azrael?" I asked. "That I'll tell you when we wake. I'll tell you everything that happened with Esther, with Gregory and the Temple of the Mind. I'll tell you." He seemed too weary to continue. He stood up and then very firmly helped me up from the chair.
"You must drink more broth, Jonathan."
He gave it to me, from a cup by the hearth, and I drank it. And then he helped me into the small bathroom of the cabin, and politely he turned his back as I made water. And then he helped me to bed. I was shaking badly. My throat was thick, my tongue swollen. I could see that he was in great anxiety. The telling of the tale had been an ordeal. He must have read my sympathy. "I'll never tell it again to anyone else," he said. "I don't ever want to say it again. I don't ever want to see the boiling cauldron." His voice dried up. He shook his head and his thick hair to wake himself, and then he helped me into the bed. He made me drink more cool water, which was very good. "Don't fear for me," I said. "I'm well. Only a little tired, a little weak." I took one last deep drink of water, then offered the bottle to him, and he drank more deeply, and he smiled. "What can I do for you now?" I asked. "You're my guest and my protector." "Would you let me sleep beside you?" he said. "As if we were just boys together in the field, so that, if the whirlwind comes for me, so that if the souls come, I can reach out and touch your warm hand." I nodded. He put me under the covers, and then he climbed in beside me. I turned towards him, and he faced away. I put my arm over him. The red velvet robe he wore felt comfortable and thick and warm. I had my arm around him. He went limp, as it were, in the covers, his head deep into the pillow, the big mass of black curls close to my face, and smelling of the clean air outside and the sweet smoke from the fire. The sunlight was just creeping under the door, and I could tell by its brightness and the warmth of the room that the snowstorm had slacked off. The fire was healthy. The morning was quiet. I woke once at noon. I was hot and mumbling and having a horrible dream. He lifted me up and gave me a big drink of cool water. He had put snow in it, and it tasted clean. I drank and drank, and then I lay back down. He seemed to shimmer, a figure clad in red with deep, black eyes. His beard and hair looked silky, and I thought of all the old texts that tell of ointments and oils and perfumes for hair. His hair was worthy of all that, I thought. There came back to me a panorama of the wall carvings I'd seen all over the world. I saw the great Assyrian carvings in the British Museum. I saw the pictures in books. The black-headed people, that was what the Sumerians had called themselves. And we had come from them, or somehow mingled in them. And I knew now that those strange carvings of bearded kings in robes were nearer to me than European emblems I'd cherished as familiar, when in fact they mattered very little at all. "You slept well?" I asked. But I was already drifting off. "Yes," he said. "You sleep now. I'm going out into the snow to walk. You sleep, you hear me? I'll have your supper for you when you wake." Chapter 8. In the very late afternoon I awoke. I could tell again by the light beneath the door that we must have a blue sky and a brightly dying sun. He wasn't in the house, which was little more than one room. I got up, wrapping my heaviest robe around me, a cashmere robe, and then I looked for him, in the little rooms off the back, the bathroom, the pantry. He wasn't there. I remembered what he said about walking in the snow, but his absence unnerved me. Then I stared down at the hearth, and I saw a large pot of broth filled with potatoes and carrots he'd put in it, and that meant I hadn't dreamt all this. Someone had come. I also felt very faintly sick. My head wasn't wondrously clear yet, the way it would feel when the illness was completely flown away. I looked down at my feet. I had on thick wool socks with leather soles. He must have put these on me. I went to the door. I had to find him, find out where he was. I was in terror suddenly that he was gone. Utter terror. I was in utter terror for a whole series of reasons, and I don't know what they were. I put on my big boots and my greatcoat, which is an enormous bulky garment, weighing a ton and made to cover the thickest sweaters, and then I opened the door. The dying sun was still gleaming on the distant snow of the mountains, but otherwise the light was gone from the sky. The world was gray and white, metallic and growing dim. I didn't see him anywhere. The air was still and tolerable as it can be in the worst winter, when for a moment there is no wind. Icicles hung from the roof above me. The snow showed no tracks. It looked fresh, and it wasn't impossibly deep. "Azrael!" I called out to him. Why was I so desperate? Did I fear for him? I knew I did. I feared for him. For me, for my sanity, for my wits, for the security and peace of my entire life. I shut the door and walked out some distance from the house. The cold began to hurt my face and hands. This was plain stupid, and I knew it. The fever would come back. I couldn't stay out here. I called to him several times and heard nothing. It was a beautiful, snow-laden scene around me in the dusk. The firs wore their snow with dignity, and the evening stars were beginning to shine. The sun had gone. But it was twilight. I noticed the car some distance away. I had been looking at it all this time, more or less, but had not noticed it because it was all covered with snow. A thought came to me. I hurried to the car, realizing that my feet were already numb, and I opened up the back of it. There was an old television set there, a portable, the kind they make for fishermen to take on boats. It had a tiny screen, and it was long and with a built-in handle, rather like a giant flashlight. It ran on D-cell batteries. I hadn't used it in years. I picked it up, closed the Jeep, and ran back to the house. As soon as I shut the door, I felt like a traitor to him. I felt as if I wanted to spy upon the world he'd spoken of, the Belkan world, the ugly, ugly world of terrorism and disgusting violence spawned by the Temple of the Mind. I shouldn't need this, I thought. Well, perhaps it won't even work. I sat down by the fire, took off my boots, and warmed my hands and feet. Stupid. Stupid, I thought. But I wasn't shivering. Then I went to the big stash of batteries, and I filled up the little television, which I held by its handle, and brought it back so that I could sit in my chair. Pulling up the aerial, I turned the dial. I had never used this thing here. It had been in the car forever. If I'd remembered it before I had left, I would not have taken it out. But in a boat I'd used it, fishing 5 summers ago. And now, as then, it worked. It brought in flashes of black and white, zigzag lines, and then finally a news voice, very distinct, with the authority of a network, summing up the latest events. I turned up the volume. The picture danced and wiggled and then flipped, but the voice was coming clear. War in the Balkans had taken another terrible turn. Shells heaved into Sarajevo had killed people in a hospital. In Japan, the cult leader had been arrested for conspiracy to commit murder. A murder had happened in a nearby town. It went on and on, the packing of fact into swift, crisp sentences. The picture was steadying. I saw an anchor woman, a news face, not distinct, but I could focus now more clearly on the voice. Horrors of the Temple of the Mind continue. All members in the Bolivian Temple are now dead, having set fire to the compound themselves rather than surrender to international agents. Meanwhile, arrests of Gregory Belkin's followers continue in New York. I was excited. I picked up the little thing and held it close to look at it. I saw blurry, fast coverage of those arrested, handcuffed and chained. Enough poisonous gas in New York City alone to have killed the entire population. Meantime, Iranian authorities have confirmed to the United Nations that all members of Belkin's temple are in custody. However, the question of extradition of the Belkin terrorists to the United States will, according to officials, take considerable time. In Cairo, it has been confirmed that all Belkin's followers have surrendered to authorities. All chemicals in their possession have been